And in a moment, we go live to the United Kingdom for the greatest storyteller ever born. That's right. Lionel Fanthorpe joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. He's an Anglican priest. He's a storyteller. He is a television host. He is Lionel Fanthorpe. Welcome back, my friend. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, George. It's always a great pleasure for me. I love being on your show.
I love getting close to Christmas when we play 'Twas the Night Before Christmas that you did for us. It's so perfect.
Oh, thank you. You're very, very kind. If my ego gets any bigger, I shall have to put the phone down and get a bigger one.
Tell me, what have you been up to lately?
Well, one of the most recent things we did was to go down to one of the places in the southwest, a lovely little village called Cadbury, which was associated with all the King Arthur stories. And we did some recording down there for a company. And then we've been talking to another company about three religious mysteries that they especially wanted me to come in on for them, one of which was the Turin Shroud, and another, which I'd not been asked about before, but which I found fascinating, was the Tower of Babel, you know, where all the languages went strange and the tower never got finished. It's sort of, you know, like a Babylonian ziggurat, one of the stepped pyramids. And then we did some other work with them. So I've been keeping pretty busy. And then we had a call to go up and investigate some of the most ancient holy places in our country of Wales, our Principality of Wales, one of which I really couldn't believe my eyes. Although we only live about 100 miles away from it, I'd never seen it before until this TV company asked me to go and talk about it. And it's the Church of St. Martin, and up in one of the Welsh villages in the Brecon Hills, what we call the Brecon Beacons. And because of the subsoil on which it was built, and there was a bit of glaciation, and the, thousands of years ago, when they put the foundations in, they were put on top of something that was liable to shift. And if you could imagine a typical English village church or British village church, and some giant had taken hold of the tower at one end and the west door at the other end and turned them in opposite directions. So the body of the church is kinked slightly towards the north. The tower is leaning at a bigger angle than the famous Leaning Tower of Pisa. Huh. And I really couldn't believe there's this little Welsh church. It's been there hundreds of years. And, of course, they've had to shore up the tower with big architectural supports. But still it stands. And I thought, well, maybe there's something of a religious parable there, that no matter how life twists us about and delivers blows, if we try hard, we can still stay upright. Well, we can still stay in position, if not completely upright. But it really is. It's worth coming to Wales just to see that.
Lionel, go ahead. Finish up.
I've got to ask you a question. Those have been my recent adventures, George.
Okay, perfect. NBC is coming out with a drama series on demonic possessions.
Right.
And you have written a book called Death. And that, what does that deal with? How did you handle that?
Well, what we looked at, the full title of that was Death, the Final Mystery. And we looked into what the different world religions, different world beliefs, and particularly what spiritualists say about it, and the evidence that we can get from mediums, ranging from the old Victorian seances with all their theatrical trimmings, up to the more modern scientific approach. And this whole idea of possession that you just mentioned, I have, over the course of the last 50 years or so, been called on, not very often, but occasionally, to exorcise not the building or a an allegedly haunted room, but somebody who thought that he or she was actually possessed by some strange entity, some dark and sinister force. Again, I can't mention the guy's name, but I had a case in the last 2 years where his friends contacted me and said that, in their opinion, their friend was demon-possessed, and he'd sunk into a deep depression, which they'd had, obviously, medical and psychological help for, but it hadn't done him any good. And they thought, as a last resort, they would call in a priest to perform an exorcism and to see whether, if there was a possibility of some strange, dark, sinister, demonic force occupying this poor man. And I went down and did the prayers of exorcism and holy water and a Bible reading or two. And suddenly there was a very, very marked change in the patient. His whole physical, you know, when somebody is badly depressed or feels as if they're at a very low point in life.
Right.
The body sort of reflects it, doesn't it? You know,
it sure does. That's right.
Yeah, so stooped position. And he straightened up, and where his face had been clouded with the depression, with the feeling of helplessness, he broke into a smile and looked absolutely normal. And he turned to me almost with tears in his eyes and said, "Oh, thank you, Father. You've done something. I feel free." And I said, "Look, you keep in touch with me." Now, this was some 2 years ago, and he hasn't reported back to say that he's been attacked again.
That's good.
So, you know, it makes you wonder, was there really some deep dark? Was the psychologists might suggest, and, you know, you and I always like to, much as we're interested in the paranormal, we always like to look at scientific and objective possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that the psychologists would suggest is that every human being on this earth has what we might call suppressed subsidiary personalities. You know, the bad guy that somebody might have been if he hadn't overcome it and become a good and moral person is somewhere hidden in the subconscious. And it may come out as a nightmare, or he may think that he's somebody else. And then he conquers it again. Now, maybe, again, according to psychological theory, what the religious among us might regard as demon possession is one of these subordinate, subsidiary personalities breaking out from the area of the mind where it has been locked away and dominated by a good personality, that thing can break out. And the poor guy who's having an interpersonality battle feels that something from outside is possessing him. But I think we need to look at both possibilities. But certainly in the case of the fellow that I was asked to go and help, there was a complete relief from all that he'd been suffering.
Have you ever investigated zombie reports, Lionel?
Well, once or twice, again, over a very long period, they tend to come from, when I was doing some of my Fortean TV series, there were accounts of particular areas where there were things that were said to be walking, and we've got some Central American and South American accounts of these. One of the strangest, of course, it goes back to a European village back in the days not long after the French Revolution. So we're talking very early 19th century, late 18th century. And it's referred to in nearly all the books of horror stories and, unsolved mysteries as the Village of the Damned. And the way that it was originally told, there was a soldier billeted in the village, and he was getting on extremely well. There was a good family looking after him. He was well fed and comfortably housed. And they were sitting down at a meal together, the mum and dad of the family and two of the children, and there's a knock at the door, which then opens, and an elderly man comes into the room. There's a deathly silence from all of the family. The old man walks up to the father of the family, puts his hand on father's shoulder, turns, and walks out again. Father is terror-stricken, and he leaves his meal, runs upstairs to the bedroom with the family in hot pursuit, and when they enter, of course the young soldier goes with them to see what on earth the trouble was, but when they get up to the father's bedroom, he is lying dead on his bed. And the soldier turns to the bereaved family and says, what's happened to him? Who was that old man who came in? And one of the children says, that was my grandfather, and he has been in his grave for 2 years.
Oh, that's now, chilling.
It really is, yeah, even in the early morning, that's chilling. Oh, anyway, goodness. There was then a further investigation, and a number of the graves were opened, and the corpses were disinterred, and duly, in some cases, dismembered. The general objective scientific explanation seems to have been that there was some sort of illness which had attacked the village, and that a number of people who had apparently been dead had only been in very severe coma, because many of the graves that were open, it looked as if there had been frantic attempts to get out, and the bodies looked as though they had woken up to find that they'd been buried alive. It's without looking at my reference book, I can't remember the name of the village, but it was called, in most of the collections, it's referred to as Village of the Damned. So a quick look on the internet and I could find the other details for you. But that's one of the most, shall we say, sinister and fearsome of the zombie stories.
Anything new with the Oak Island mystery? Has anybody ever solved that?
No, we still haven't solved Oak Island. It's one of the biggest mysteries, I think. I would put it in the top seven if we were looking for, you know, like seven wonders of the world, world great mysteries. And just running over the basics of it again, it was way back in 1795. Three teenaged lads, Smith, Bourne, and McGinnis, had been given a day off by their caring parents because life in Nova Scotia at the end of the 18th century demanded enormously hard work. You could either be a fisherman, or you could be a forester, or you could be a farmer. And they were all really demanding. And these three lads, as they were with loving parents, had said, look, we can't get a break, but you three guys, go and have a day off. And they paddled out to Oak Island, which was in Mahone Bay, and a Mahone was, in those days, the name of a sailing ship that was much favoured by pirates, so we might call it Pirate Ship Bay if we updated the title. But Mahone Bay has over 300 little islands dotted around in it. The boys paddled out to Oak Island, went to explore, it was then uninhabited, and they found that one particularly big, sturdy oak tree had a branch lopped fairly high up. From that branch there hung an old ship's block and tackle, which had almost decayed away. And when the boys fiddled with it, it fell down. They then saw that the ground underneath had obviously been disturbed. And I think if we had been teenage boys way back in 1795, and, you know, sometimes I think I must have been. And these three lads then thought of pirate treasure and went back to get some digging equipment and started to dig. into the top of this shaft. Well, they'd been at it for a while, and they came to a platform of oak logs set horizontally across the shaft. The sides were brick hard, but the backfill was coming out pretty easily. They got down another 10 feet, which was a pretty good feat for a, you know, for three lads. And then they realized they couldn't do it on their own. They needed a bigger expedition. So word went round among fathers and uncles and grandparents, anybody who was able to come and help. And an expedition was mounted. They brought horses with them and better digging equipment. And they got down to 100 feet, at which point they had somehow cut into the trigger mechanism of the two flood tunnels that the builders of that shaft had placed there, so that if anyone who didn't know about the flood tunnels attempted to get down the shaft, they would probably drown when the Atlantic poured in from Mahone Bay. Anyway, they did escape without loss of life, and when they got one of the men out who'd been caught in the water, his first words to his boss were, "Hey, this is salt water." And that's how they realized that the flood tunnels had come in from the Atlantic
from
side.
The ocean. That's true. Yeah. How much treasure do you think might be down there?
Well, what's come up over the years on various drill bits have been a few links of gold chain, a jewel, which was then stolen by the man who was operating the drill, who ran off with it, and a tiny scrap of parchment, which is really the most interesting thing, because whatever is down there, something important has been written there. And there are all sorts of theories as to what it might be. One of them takes us over to my old favorite mystery of Rennes-le-Château, where there's a possibility that some of the treasure from Rennes may have been carried across there. But that was long before Béranger Saunier, the priest, became rich. And another thought is that in 1307, when the Templars were attacked by Philip IV, known as Philippe la Belle, that they escaped with their fleet from La Rochelle and, following the old Viking trade routes up the coast of Europe and then across by Iceland and Greenland, down the Canadian coast, and finding these islands in Mahone Bay, they buried whatever they'd got. And now the Templars, as well as being very, very fearsome warriors, were also brilliant architects. There still exists in the Middle East one of their fortresses known as the Crac du Chevalier, which is a piece of superb military engineering. And guys who could build a fortress like Crac du Chevalier above ground would also be capable of putting something very, very efficient underground to guard their treasure. Third theory is that there were Coptic Christians in Egypt who escaped with their leader from persecution, mm-hmm. that they made it all the way across to Oak Island, where when he finally died, they buried their religious leader in a protected grave.
That could very well be the case. That could be the case. Lionel, stay with us. We're going to come back, finish up with Oak Island, then get into some of the other world mysteries. Lionel Fanthorpe, our guest here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk about lucid dreaming with Giovanni Lordi. So get ready for that. And when we come back in a moment, more of the great stories from Lionel Fanthorpe on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Lionel Fanthorpe, with us. Lionel, let's finish up with Oak Island. What a great mystery that is. How come there's not a major concerted effort to try to figure out what's going on there?
Well, one of the things that have been said rather cynically, skeptically about the Oak Island money pit is that it should be called the money pit because more money has gone down it than has ever come out of it.
Out of it, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the most amazing stories connected with it was during the 19th century, when a lot of expeditions were trying things, there were two incredibly brave but impractical members of an expedition that was led by a guy called Mitchell. And they said, "Mr. Mitchell, if we were to dig a parallel shaft, maybe 10, 15 feet away from the flooded shaft, then, as we know from the drill samples that the treasure is right at the bottom, we could then drill across from our parallel shaft and find the treasure that way without any problem with the water." Well, when I was a kid in school, we had a physics teacher who, among other things, told us in rhyme that a pint of pure water weighs a pound and a quarter. Now, you imagine a shaft 13 feet across, 100 feet deep in water, and every pint of that has got a weight of just over a pound. Man, have you got pressure in there. So these two brave heroes go down their parallel shaft. They get down to the bottom of the flooded shaft, and they're still bone dry, and they're looking at each other, and they're saying, "This is really going to work." And they call up to Mitchell, and, "Mr. Mitchell, we're just drilling across now." Next moment, they arrived on the surface, on top of 100 feet of water that had come through. Where they'd burst through into the flooded shaft, The water had hit back, and they were remarkably lucky to have come out on top of it and emerged alive when Mitchell and the rest of the team grabbed them, pulled them to safety. And they are recorded as making what was probably the most obvious statement in all of human history. "Mr. Mitchell, we don't think it's going to work, sir." I love that. Yeah.
What has been your favorite mystery of all times?
Well, I think the one that I like best is the mystery on Barbados, and that is a tomb which belonged to a family called Chase Elliott, who had once been plantation owners there on Barbados. We're going back to the start of the 19th century. And in this particular tomb, which I know very well because the BBC asked me to do a documentary on it a few years ago, and Patricia and I have actually stood in this remarkable, sinister old place. So if you can imagine, about the size of the average living room, a small living room, and you approach it, the top of the tomb is at ground level. So you go down a flight of 14 steps, and at the top of the steps, it was originally closed by a big Devonshire marble slab. So the story began round about 1815, 1816, and it continued for a period of years. The coffins that were used on Barbados at that time, it's a place called Christchurch, which is just near the little fishing village of St. Oystins. And every time a member of the Chase Elliott family died, as was customary, the coffin was encased in lead, because a wooden coffin wouldn't stand up to that tropical climate for very long. Every time, after the mystery began at the start of the 19th century, when a new body was carried down those steps and placed in the vault, the other coffins had moved. Now, you and I are pretty strong guys, but it would need 10 like us, I would reckon, to shift a coffin weighing a ton. And these had been just moved around as though by a giant hand invisible at the foot of those stairs. And when this had happened on 6 or 7 occasions, you could imagine the rumors and the stories, the panic that was going around the island. And Lord Combermere, who had fought with the Duke of Wellington on the Spanish Peninsula during the war against Napoleon, he'd been a cavalry commander, and had been rewarded after the war with the governorship of Barbados. And so he was quite a tough guy. And he said to the vicar, who was Reverend Orderson, look, we've got to stop this. I would like to sand the floor, and then I'd like to seal the top of the vault where that big blue Devonshire marble slab goes down. And then we'll open it again in a few weeks and see what, if anything, has happened. And Orderson said, yes, sir. And he said, you're the governor. I'm happy with that. And so the governor's plans were put into operation. The floor was covered. The coffins were all placed in order. The floor was covered with this white coral stone sand that would show any mark. And then the big blue Devonshire slab was cemented in place to block any possibility of entry. And several of the leading citizens of Barbados pushed their signet rings into the wet cement so that those seals would show instantly if that slab had been disturbed. So some 6 weeks later, Combermere gave the order, we will now re-enter the vault. First they checked the big marble slab. Everything was in perfect condition. Nothing had been moved. The seals were intact. But when they lifted the slab, the biggest of the coffins containing the body of the Honourable Thomas Chase, who'd been the head of the family, was three quarters of the way up the staircase, and that was enough for Lord Combermere. He turns to the vicar and he says, right, Father Orderson, I want every one of them out of that vault. I want each one in his own grave, 6 foot down. And I want that vault left open for eternity. And his orders were obeyed. And when Patricia and I went over there to make the documentary for the Beeb, the government on Barbados, their tourist department, were so keen to have a BBC program made about it to attract the tourists that they lent us a very nice guy who had won the award of Taxi Driver of the Year in the previous year. And he was marvelous, looked after us, you know, like a brother, took us everywhere, showed us all the things we wanted to see to and from the hotel and helped with the equipment. He was very, very nice guy. But when I was down in the vault and I thought, no, he's got a lovely, rich voice. He would sound superb on my documentary. So I called up to him, would you come down here with us and tell us what you think? And he rolled his eyes and said, not after what my grandmother told me, man. I'm not going down there.
Nothing to do with it, huh?
No, he didn't want to. He'd help us in any way we wanted, but he didn't want to come down the vault. Then he did a sort of double take, and he looked down the steps to where I was standing and said, if you're there, I'll come. I'm not going down on my own. And I said, fine, I'll stay here. We'll do a little bit of the broadcast together, which we did. And I felt very complimented because he was a big, strong, strapping guy. And I thought, well, if you're prepared to have me as your protector, I'm very complimented.
Did you ever do stories on curses?
Yes. Yes, we have on numerous cursed objects, as well as cursed locations. And, of course, there's the famous Hope Diamond was believed to carry a curse. There are a number of objects that we think of the curse of Tutankhamun. And I got a personal connection with that. It's almost an indirect one because, you know, as we all know, the story of the opening of the tomb of Tutankhamun,
yeah.
How it was Howard Carter, the archaeologist who found it, with Lord Carnarvon. Well, Howard Carter was a Norfolk man, and he had a cousin called Harry. And when I was a boy at school, back in the early 1940s, as I was born in 1935, so I'd have known this guy in about 1945. And, of course, when the Tutankhamun story was still very much in everybody's mind. And Harry Carter, cousin of the famous Howard Carter, was our woodwork teacher. And you could imagine us kids with our minds full of the curse of Tutankhamun saying to our poor woodwork teacher while he was trying to teach us how to make things, "Hey, sir, what did your cousin find in the tomb, sir?" And he was, "We are not talking about the tomb, my boy. We're talking about how to make a bookcase. Now get that screwdriver." "Yes, sir." It was a very, very strange business. One of the factors with these allegedly cursed objects, I think, depends upon the working of the human mind.
How so?
That if we believe that something is evil, something is dangerous, something can affect us in a negative way, then we are likely to run into the kind of difficulty that we do when we are feeling scared rather than totally rational and in charge of the situation. And I think that if somebody is told that an object is cursed, well, I go back to the Barbados tomb for a minute. My director-producer back in the UK had said, if possible, get in touch with an Obeah man or a voodoo priest or anybody on the island who's into that and ask him for his opinion. So I eventually tracked one down and I got him to contribute to the broadcast I was making. And he broke into a strange tale about a man who had been there some years before and had picked up a piece of stone from the bottom of the tomb and had taken it back to Britain with him. And he had previously had a good job, which he lost. All his stocks and shares failed on the stock market. He lost all his money. He had had a very loving partner who suddenly changed her mind and left him. And he'd always been in good health, and he suddenly became chronically ill. He then sent the stone back to Barbados with a plea that it should be put back in the tomb. The minute it had been put back in the tomb, his former partner came back to him and they resumed their loving relationship. He got a better job than the one he lost, and he won a packet on a big raffle so that his missing money was restored and his health improved. And there's this guy telling me all this about, you know, the effect of this cursed object, and I already had one in my pocket. I just picked it up. And it now sits in my china cabinet here in Cardiff. And I am, despite being 80 next birthday, I still feel 40. I have a very loving partner, and I'm financially okay.
Good for you.
So whatever it was, I can say that it's, I think, if we believe an object is cursed, we are able to do strange things with our subconscious mind that will bring about the ill effects we don't want.
The mysteries and secrets of the Masons. We've only got about 4 or 5 minutes left.
Yes, okay. Well, I myself, my mother lodge, as we say in the craft, was dedicated to Bishop Bowers of Norwich, and my father was up in provincial rank, and I have, over the years, had so many good friends who were Brother Masons, and I know them to be among the best and the kindest and the most honest, and there's a big Masonic hospital, there are Masonic schools, they do an enormous amount of good work, but going way back into history, there are, or I think they would say that there are many pieces of evidence that there are certain organizations which can exert a tremendous lot of influence. And there have even been suggestions that there is what we might call an order of guardians. And they set out, they have special knowledge, and they set out to protect the rest of us from other significant and powerful dark groups who we might call the opposite of the guardians, who become terrorists of one sort or another. And in its earliest days, I believe that Freemasonry was, shall we say, like the tip of an iceberg. It was a group of these very ancient guardians who were there for the benefit of the human race, and such secrets as they have, very interesting and important ones. And it's, I think they do. The good that we see on the surface is fine, but I think they do a lot of hidden good underneath. And it's not a thing, you know, to be taken lightly. There are some very deep and important Masonic secrets which are there for the benefit of the rest of us, rather than otherwise.
Amazing work, Lionel. As we get close to saying goodnight to you, what are your next projects?
Well, we're currently doing research into vampirism in the UK. There's the famous Croglin Grange vampire, which was up in the northwest of England. But there are a great many more vampire stories as yet untold, and that's what we are currently working on, the mystery of the vampires in the UK.
Are there many reports?
Well, there was the very famous one from Highgate Cemetery a few years ago, and it is quite surprising when you delve deeply into it as to how many reports there were over the last 100 years. There do seem to have been some very... And, of course, what I think we need to bear in mind is that there are what I would refer to as psychic vampires rather than blood-sucking vampires. And these are beings which can drain energy in strange ways. So that's what we're delving into at the moment.
Lionel, say the best you can to Patricia for us.
And, I will indeed.
You take care. We'll talk to you maybe before Christmas. Let's do that.
That would be great. I'm always here when you need me.
Okay, my friend. Be well.
Thanks again, and you. Bye.
Lionel Stanford. There he is. He's live in the United Kingdom. I have always said he is by far the greatest storyteller ever born. On our Friday night into Saturday morning program again, we're going to talk about lucid dreaming. And then, of course, we will have open lines for you on Coast to Coast AM. And follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, if you would. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.